a sneaker that you put on your foot, you don't think about the fact that that is 100% plastic typically, and plastic from petroleum. Essentially, everyone is walking around with just a bucket of petroleum on their feet.
I'm your host, Adam Mett, and today we're chatting with Joey Zwillinger, co-founder of the shoe company Allbirds. We talk about the fashion industry, corporate responsibility, and why sustainability is baked into his company's mission. A quick reminder that we're planting a tree for every person who subscribes to this podcast, so make sure to hit that subscribe button. And without further ado, here is Joey Zwillinger on Planet Reimagined. So somehow you managed to create a shoe that makes my feet feel amazing and makes me feel really good about my environmental choices. Was this the intention? And how did you do this?
So that was the intent. Tim and I started this company in 2015 together. And we identified an opportunity where the whole industry was kind of paying lip service to sustainability. And we realized that that was an opportunity to lead, but also a really cool opportunity to use materials that the rest of the industry was ignoring. And even though they happen to be better for the planet, they'd also just be different and feel really good. And so we thought that was a very intriguing opportunity and could translate that if we did a really good job of making a product that did exactly what you just described, which is feel amazing when you put them on your feet, first and foremost. And we've always had the view that consumers buy great products, not sustainable ones, but that truly great products are also sustainable. And so that was the goal. And if we felt like if we were successful, and this sounds a little lofty, and I don't mean it to sound arrogant at all, but what we tried to do was create a business where the environmental goals of the business were highly aligned with the financial goals of the business. So the tension that people typically think about is, if you do great for the environment, you do bad for the business, or great for the business, bad for the environment. And we felt like there was an opportunity to chop that paradigm down and build a new one where you could have a great business that's aligned with environmental goals. So every time you bought one of our shoes instead of from another brand, you're doing something slightly on the margin better for the planet. And that decision is great, and it helps our business, but it also helps the planet be better. So that was our ideal, and that was kind of how we set about building this business.
It's incredible. And just as a caveat, I don't want this whole episode to sound like an ad, but I am a big fan of the brand. I bought 4 pairs of shoes in the last year. I have the high top Mizzle wool ones. I have the low top one there. The wool runners, they're all fantastic.
Yeah, cool. And that's awesome. Them. Thank you. I appreciate that.
All the time we hear the term fast fashion about sustainability in the fashion space. But why is sustainability something that we need to worry about, particularly in the shoe industry? And in what ways are shoes particularly harmful to the environment?
The fast in fast fashion, it is really one of the root causes of some of the issues in the fashion industry. Because when you're oriented around speed, and you read a lot about, particularly in apparel, but this is true across the whole industry, when you orient around speed, you're incentivized to use the lowest cost materials and move them to the customer the quickest. And it nowhere in what I just said is in the best way for the planet. That's not fast fashion. Fast fashion is, you know, even if you make a little excess, whatever, just burn the excess because, you know, who cares? It was so cheap. This isn't going to affect our bottom line. Don't even bother discounting it. Just literally burn it. I mean, it can be that bad. And so we've really tried to slow it down in a big way and use materials that are, you know, they take ages. And we harvest our materials sometimes well in excess of a year of when we use them to make one of our products. For example, with merino wool, that's an annual shearing of the sheep to get the wool off their back, which helps for health and safety for the animals. But then it takes a very long time to process that and put that into a shoe. And that creates a better product, but it's definitely not faster. And so we have to manage through that. In the shoe industry, to your question, there's been some jujitsu over the past decades. You don't think about a sneaker that you put on your foot. You don't think about the fact that that is 100% plastic, typically, and plastic from petroleum. essentially everyone is walking around with just a bucket of petroleum on their feet. And oftentimes you add to that hide from animals, and particularly from cows. And so if you combine the idea that almost everyone of the 20 billion pairs of shoes that are produced annually and sold annually across the world, and that, you know, hundreds of millions, it's about 2.5 billion pairs of shoes in America that are sold every year. It's all just plastic from petroleum and leather from animals. So the carbon emissions of fossil fuels being used to produce shoes is a tremendous impact on the environment. And oftentimes the leather industry, which, you know, reduces the cost of meat because it's a co-product of meat production and encourages more grazing of animals that are not done in the most environmentally sensitive way. And then the chrome tanning process and the use of harsh chemicals when you tan the leathers, and what happens to those chemicals just accumulating in nature and really having a very, very long half-life before they degrade. These are things that are not being conscientious for the environment. And all of this stuff just ends up in landfills. And so the end of life is not being considered, and all these chemicals and all the plastic that's sitting there is not good for the planet. And the volume is just so high. So, you know, the best information we can understand is the fashion industry is responsible for about somewhere between 5 to 10% of the global greenhouse gas emissions that industry is producing. And then if you just look at the impact on the sheer volume in the U.S., 2.5 billion pairs ending up in landfills every year, the volume is just very, very substantial.
Definitely. You brought up a few things that I want to dive a little bit deeper into. You talked about wool, and you also talked about grazing. And because the majority of your shoes are made from wool, from sheep, and grazing ground for livestock contributes tremendously to greenhouse gases in a variety of ways, deforestation being one of them. How is your use of wool actually sustainable?
Yeah, and there's a few issues packed into that question, but we've tried to use the best materials that are the lowest impact on the planet that we can. And sheep farming in general, forget about some of the issues you mentioned, like deforestation. We are way far away from any kind of forest. In fact, New Zealand is where we source most of our wool from, and that's really not an issue. But there are emissions in sheep production, and sheep just being a ruminant animal, you know, they eat grass and they burp, and the burps contain greenhouse gases. They include methane in there. And so we count that in the production and the impact of our shoe. And we do a lot to count that up and then offset that. What we've tried to do is look at the actual source. So our merino wool comes from New Zealand. It's certified by a group called New Zealand Merino. And that is the lowest impact, most environmentally sensitive methodology to get wool from merino sheep. And merino sheep in general, they graze in high country of New Zealand. So this is like 2 acres per sheep, unbelievably beautiful mountainous land. And it's not what you're picturing when you're picturing one of these feedlots for beef or something like that. Like, this is beautiful spread out country where they're grazing in natural environments with very little supplemental feed. And we're also anchoring very significantly around the idea of regenerative agriculture, which I think is one of the unsung potential heroes in terms of fighting climate change, where you can actually sequester carbon in the soil by using particular techniques like high intensive grazing in certain areas and crop rotation. These are things that we're working with our growers. We have about 100 growers in New Zealand to actually introduce these techniques so that the carbon emissions go down and can even be negative in some circumstances. So these are things we're working on. And I'll just add, we also have a number of other components. Our sweet foam, the bottoms of our shoes, those are actually the raw materials that we source because we've done development with this innovative chemical company down in Brazil. Is it's actually carbon negative. So it's sucking carbon dioxide equivalent emissions out of the atmosphere to produce that material. And our tree material is also one of the lowest carbon impact materials on the planet. Wool, tree, the tree material, and our sweet foam from sugarcane. These are sensitive on the environment, and they're just better. They feel great. And that's to your first question, like, how do we make it good for the planet and good for people's feet? And this is the balance that we're trying to strike, and the innovation that we're looking for means that it's better for you as pragmatically just comfort walking around New York, and it's also better for the planet.
I can absolutely attest to that. I want to zoom out just a little bit and talk about greenwashing because it is a really big problem. Sustainability is great for PR, and there are so many companies that say that their work and their products are sustainable, but a lot of them are not actually taking meaningful or any real concrete action. Do you think this is a trend that is going to continue?
Yeah, I'm very worried about it. For a whole host of reasons. You know, back in the mid zeros, I don't know how you say that decade, like 2005, 2008, in that zone, oil spiked incredibly high, if you remember. And during that period of time, there was an environmental movement to push for clean energy, biofuels, and a lot of things like that. And unfortunately, it dissipated. But during that period of time when interest was peaked for consumers, there was a ton of greenwashing. And then it kind of subsided. Everyone went back to business as usual. Fortunately, this time around, it feels different. Like oil prices are still low and the issue of climate change is now on a lot of people's mind. I was just reading kind of statistics about Americans' polling data that over a third of Americans believe this is an incredibly important issue for Congress to take action on, which is very encouraging, particularly in a period of time when oil prices are actually low. And so it's not affecting their wallets as much to say so. Greenwashing, we're seeing it every day. We're very concerned about it because I think the issue is consumers don't know how to choose between products. They don't know. It's confusing to understand what you should buy and how you should make decisions to help solve that problem. And so you default to just kind of doing business as usual as a consumer, a big issue. And one of the reasons why in the midst of this pandemic, we started releasing the emission scores for all of our products. So if you look at one of our products now, every single one is labeled with the carbon impact of the production of that and sale of that product and use, I should say. But the whole life cycle, we counted every gram of carbon equivalent emission that is produced through the use and manufacture of our products. And what we hope that translates to is something equivalent to like a food nutrition label where you know how many calories are on the back of that. And if you know how many calories, you can now make an informed decision on whether you should eat that or choose something different. And our idea here is if people start to have more information and there's a standardized methodology to share that information, now consumers have a choice and they can choose between quality, style, price, and carbon emission. And that now with informed consumers can help us avoid the pitfalls of people just slapping a label on it that says sustainable. And in reality, it's doing quite a bit of harm for the planet.
So that's a public-facing set of standardization ideas. The idea of corporate social responsibility or CSR traditionally are more internal parameters that are set by companies. Do you think it would be helpful to have a standardized set of CSR measures as well?
I do. There are some that exist, with varying degrees of goodness.
Enforceability.
enforceability, forget about that at the moment. But for public companies, there's some disclosures that many companies utilize. They're pretty weak and they're more oriented around the idea of disclosure versus disclosing good data. As long as you put anything out there, you have a good score. And I know you're familiar with the topic of B Corps, but we have certified as a public benefit corporation, or that's how we chartered our business, which we've always oriented around the idea that shareholders are the only stakeholder that matters for a business is something that is a fallacy. When that became the norm back in kind of the early 70s, it really started to pick up steam. And the rules of the game back then were a little different. Like business did contribute more societally and focus more on stakeholders. And so when that idea of, I'll call it shareholder primacy, became so significant, yeah, the rules were a little bit different. And those rules have really eroded now. And stakeholder capitalism, as a way I would describe what Allbirds is trying to do, is different than shareholder capitalism, where everything is oriented around growth of equity value. You know, we have to consider employees and customers and the communities we work in, and very importantly, the environment, amongst others. Being a public benefit corporation helps us anchor in that concept. And then certifying as a B Corp, that's a third-party nonprofit association, and they have an assessment that tries to describe CSR for every company that could possibly exist. And that's obviously a very difficult undertaking, and it's going to be imperfect almost inherently. But it does a great job of tackling as many issues as it could possibly do to make equivalency and scoring for a global shoe company and a local grocery store. And both can be B Corps and both have metrics that are judged. But the idea is to overall create balance. And so we've done that assessment since 2015, and we've been certified as a B Corp since then. And, you know, that is a really interesting mechanism to evaluate how good people are doing on various aspects and the transparency of how each company performs in elements across different stakeholders is high. And so you get to know what the company that you're buying services or products from, how they're doing, not just for their shareholders, but also for people that make an impact on your life as a consumer. So I think that's trending in the right direction. And it is tackling the issue that you're describing, which is standardization of corporate social responsibility and maybe EESG, as I would call it more broadly.
It's funny that you talk about stakeholders, because this is what I write about in the academic space all the time. And my dissertation essentially creates a framework for stakeholder relations and stakeholder engagements for sustainable development projects across the world. And I'm focusing on energy. So for example, I'm writing about a case in Canada where there is an indigenous population that are actually the primary shareholders in a hydroelectric plant. And so looking at the way they brought in the companies to build the hydroelectric plant, where the human rights laws were of primacy there. And while sustainability was something very important to them, they focused on protecting their own rights. Versus an example that I'm writing about in Kenya, where a company came in and said, okay, we're going to build a wind farm. It's fantastic. We're going to bring clean electricity to 22 million people, but we're going to kick 25,000 indigenous people off of their land. So creating a model for stakeholder engagement is something that I'm really passionate and excited about, and it surrounds a lot of the work that I do.
Well, I mean, I think it's fascinating. And if you zoom out at a federal level, we've missed so many great opportunities as a country to design policy that affects human rights and environmental objectives that would help the whole world when we do our trade policy. If you think about, you know, the American consumer is the most important consumer in the world to a business, particularly for higher GDP. It's the largest consumption base for any product virtually that you can think of globally. And so with that consumerism that is the basis of the American economy, when we import products from countries, it'd be nice if maybe some of the tariffs that were imposed on those regions and the products of where they came from were levied in such a way that it oriented towards making positive progress for the environment and positive progress for human rights. And for example, if a country is 100% clean energy produced so that when products are manufactured in that country, they're done with very low impact on the planet, why wouldn't those have very low levied of taxes and tariffs? And in a place where there's 80% or 100% coal production for the electric grid, why not put high tariffs on those products? That sort of mindset and understanding the power that we have and thinking about the aspect of making global progress on global issues like climate change, it's a missed opportunity. And it's been disappointing for me to see the lack of action for really as long as I've been alive.
I couldn't agree more. I want to kind of transition a little bit and talk a little bit about you. You've built sustainability into Allbirds as a business, but is this something that you model in your own life as well?
Yeah, I mean, I try to. I'm no picture of perfection by any stretch, but I try. You know, look, I have my house is virtually 100% off the grid. I got solar power. There's a company that I love to support called Cool Effect, where as a consumer, you can go onto their website and you can offset your carbon impact as a human being. And you can kind of model out what you think you emit and then pay for those in the form of well-audited and rigorously audited carbon offsets. So I'm a carbon neutral individual as well. You know, I try to segregate my waste streams. So I think that's a pretty big impact. And I try to cut down on beef consumption, although I still eat some beef, which is an area that does have high impact. So I'm cognizant of my choices and I try to do the right thing. But, you know, it's difficult. It's difficult to do it. And it's also expensive. You know, like solar is not something that is available for everyone. And a lot of this I wish was just done for us, such that the government invested in clean power production so we didn't have to make those choices.
Absolutely. I try and do these things in my life as well. And I always have this kind of moral quandary about carbon offsets because they are a really good thing, but at the same time, they're kind of problematic because a lot of people have the mindset, okay, I'm putting this carbon into the atmosphere and then, oh, I'll just pay later to do something that will pull it out. And when you plant trees or something similar to offset your carbon, it'll pull out that carbon, but over the life of that tree. And this is something that needs to be addressed immediately because obviously we're running up against time here. So in terms of you personally, but also Allbirds as a business, how much do you think about carbon offsets and how problematic they are?
So I think that carbon offsets have come a long way and that there's really good audit standards to prevent against the issue that you've described. And so I do think that they're legit and they're real. That said, the moral hazard that you're describing is real. And if you think that you can just consume more and waste more and then pay for it, that's not going to get us into a good place. So the way we think about it is we got to measure our impact and then we have to do everything we damn well possible can to reduce it. But in the meantime, if we're going to still have some impact on the planet, we should pay for it. And that's where offsets come in. And so that's sort of the order of hierarchy that we think about how we do that. And we have fairly sophisticated mechanisms inside the company to measure trade-offs and make sure we're orienting and creating balance for all of our stakeholders with a bias towards advancing our goal against pollution.
Now, on the customer side, how, as a business, can you tell if your customers actually care about sustainability? Are there any measurement tools that you use?
Difficult question to answer surgically. I mean, I think the overall success that we've enjoyed early in our life as a company is a testament to the fact that consumers care. So that's a very soft answer, but I think it's not to be overlooked. And, you know, we've always believed customers want great products, not sustainable ones. And we've come to believe that really great products are also sustainable. That's what consumers want. In my previous life, I sold renewable ingredients, like green chemicals, into various consumer-branded companies. And those companies would say that they wanted sustainability. But when it came time to buying our product, it was like, actually, can we just do what we do now and do it cheaper? And it was just a pure cost exercise. They didn't really care. And you ask about greenwashing, like that was eye-opening for me. So that led me to believe that consumers really do care. And the technology exists to deliver no compromise, great performance, and low impact on the planet. And consumers want it. They'll pay for it. They really want it. But they don't want to have to sacrifice what feels good or what performs well or whatever the product is. They don't want to have to sacrifice anything for the sake of the planet. They want to have their cake and eat it too. And they can. Like that opportunity exists. I was at a company that made stuff that was better performing and better impact on the planet. We now curate those kinds of ingredients at Allbirds so that we make sure that we use vegetable oil to make an amazing insole so that underneath your foot, you feel squishy, comfortable, and amazing over the life of your shoe. And it's low impact on the planet because it's from veg oil instead of from petroleum. So these choices are there. The brands just have to have the willpower to do it. And so I'm intuitively certain that consumers care. I'm also of the opinion that they don't want to have to sacrifice. And so companies got to get on with it and do the hard work of innovating to make sure that you can have that no compromise offering.
Absolutely. On this podcast, we talk a lot about all the different facets of sustainability. And we really like to make it clear that it's not just about climate. It touches everything from poverty to health, inequality, education, et cetera. What does Allbirds do in terms of the other areas of sustainability that are not just climate focused?
Yeah, you know, and it's one of the great challenges. If you ask 10 people on the street, what does sustainability mean? You very likely could get 10 different answers. And so, you know, maybe as a word, we have some work to do in terms of defining what companies mean. And I do think it leads to that susceptibility for deceptive marketing because you can say sustainable and mean something that isn't really very high impact for the planet or for people. So yeah, I think your point's valid, I guess is a long way of saying that. And climate change, we believe, I think a lot of people are coming around to this conclusion that This is the problem of our generation. This is like the beating of the heart. And if we can't solve climate change, the heart will stop beating and our species will cease to exist in any way that we want to live on this planet. And so that's an existential crisis, and that is worth fighting for. And that is worth my personal energy of how I spend, you know, the few years I have on the planet. That's what I want to try to make an impact on. And that is the North Star of our company. And we orient around that in a very significant way. However, to your question, it's not to the exclusion of being mindful of a lot of other aspects. And, you know, even goes into the social sphere of making sure that we provide living wages for everyone in our supply chain and that anything related to human rights is well taken care of. In terms of animal welfare and the harvesting of the land and the use of land, we use third-party certifications to ensure we have transparency so that every little fiber of wool, we know exactly where it comes from what farm, and what practices that farm uses in terms of managing the land, disposing of any kind of waste streams on that property. We know everything about that. We use Forest Stewardship Council to certify all of our tree products to make sure they're in areas of the world and they're taken from areas of the world where land use is managed extremely well and the carbon capture is as high as it possibly can. So all of these things are important. And then the impact and disproportional impact on various populations, typically lower socioeconomic people getting higher negative impact from the effects of negative environmental consequences, I guess, from businesses. That's real. And that's something that needs to have awareness. And we need to bring a big tent in terms of the kind of people who are coming under this umbrella of sustainability to make sure that they're advocating for themselves, but for the world more broadly. And I think that's been a miss of the environmental community. And I think that's, you know, to the extent that you're alluding to that concept of this over-narrowing of sustainability and what that means, I think that there is a missed opportunity. And we'd love to be part of that solution to broaden the banner of what sustainability means and who it impacts and how we get out of this mess.
So you have so many ideas about sustainability and human rights and many other things. Would you ever consider taking these ideas outside of the private sector and running for political office? By the way, I ask this question to every single guest that comes on the podcast.
You know, I don't know. You look around right now and politics is pretty divisive. It's pretty messy. So it's intriguing when you look at what is within our company's control and what is outside of our control. And realizing that there's only so much the private sector can do and that the intersection with public policy and thoughtful design of policy is important to look at both sides of that. And so if ever I were to be able to make an impact on that side, that seems exciting because the opportunity is there and we've missed so many opportunities in the past decades. Right now, particularly with the divisiveness in politics, there's a vacuum of leadership, and particularly on environmental issues. And if we can, as a member of the private sector, all birds, step up and provide some form of education and leadership on these issues, it's a very powerful opportunity for us to lead in that. And I think the impact that we can make is not to be trivialized. We can really do a big step forward. And even in some of the partnerships that we're finding today, you know, we've joined forces with Adidas, which, you know, is a legacy company in the footwear industry, been around for decades, doing things the normal old way. And they've come to the table with us to try to do a race to zero carbon because they understand that that's where the consumer's headed. And collective action in the private sector, individual action and storytelling, these are really powerful ways to make an impact. And we've got so much more work to do. We're just a drop in the bucket of this giant industry right now that if we can keep doing the work we're doing, I'm pretty confident that my impact personally will be substantial. So I'm really content doing what we're doing and having a lot of fun and working with great people and bringing some delight to customers like your lives when you step into our shoes.
Amazing. I have one last question for you, and it's a two-parter. We get so many people reaching out to us saying, what can we do? How can we participate? What's the first step we should be taking? If you had a piece of advice for individuals to make their lives more sustainable, what would it be? And then on the flip side, because you've built a business that is incredibly sustainable, for people who are starting a business, what would be your advice to take a sustainable approach in starting a business?
Well, yeah, on the individual side, I do think there's a lot you can do. Being conscious of it when you're making decisions in your daily life, There's so many simple things that you can do. And it's also, it's challenging to understand which of those decisions make the highest impact. And so getting educated first and foremost is really important. And the resources that are out there to kind of show you what different kinds of behavior, what kind of energy use in your home is going to be highest impact. You know, for example, your automatic dryer is going to be your highest energy consumption in your home, most likely. And your meat consumption will make a super high impact. Whereas if you, you know, use a plastic straw, which has gained a lot of popularity, that's probably not going to actually do too much negative, albeit it's something that's gained popularity. So I think cutting through the noise and making decisions on an objective basis on how it impacts the environment, it's not that hard. It takes a little bit of work. And I think once you get over the hump of that education hurdle, you can make a big impact and you can be a part of the solution. And then on the business side, it's got to be woven into the DNA of the company. CSR, you used that word earlier, and I have a negative connotation associated with that word because it typically is an appendage added to the body of the company. It's almost like, okay, forgive me for my sins. I've done all this bad stuff, but I have this awesome CSR program. That's not woven into the DNA. That's kind of like making a mess and then sweeping it away. I would advocate for anyone thinking about starting a business or reorienting an existing business and really thinking about changing the way. And this goes up to the largest businesses in the world. Think about where you make the most impact. If you make a product, the highest impact by a large margin is going to be in the materials you source. So where do those materials you source come from? And what is the impact of the production of those materials on the planet? And then next, where do you make your product? And what's the electric grid? What kind of power consumption and what kind of power source is used to manufacture that product? It's got to be that deep. And if you don't do the work to make that clear and look really deeply into how you run your business and what the, like, just like you look at your cost structure as a business, look at your sustainability and impact structure and go deep, and where you can move the needle the most, focus there. That's the way we built this business from the ground up. We knew materials were the epicenter of impact and that public policy could impact power generation more than we could ever impact. So let's focus on materials and let's drive those down to next to zero to as fast as we can so that we can create a company that makes amazing shoes and other products, but is more like a tree than it is an actual typical product company where it's actually giving back more to the planet than it's extracting. If you can have that goal and you build your company from the ground up to look that way, you're going to make a business that has the multiple effect of great products and great impact.
I love that. Thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it.
Great to talk with you, Adam. And I appreciate you doing this podcast. It's super important work. And so really appreciate it and thankful for being a guest.
Thanks so much for listening. If you want to support this podcast, please visit sustainablepartnersinc.org/donate. Also, follow us on Instagram at sustainable.partners. Today's episode was engineered by Drew Alsbrook, produced and edited by Shelby Kaufman, and executive produced by Sustainable Partners, Inc. I'm your host, Adam Mett, and thanks for listening to Planet Reimagined.